Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In the wake of the horrifying rampage by a U.S. soldier on Sunday, a new rift is being reported in the Obama administration on how quickly to get out of Afghanistan. Once again, according to the New York Times today, it is Vice President Joe Biden who wants the fastest drawdown and the commanders in the field who want to stay the longest. Let's talk about it with Stephen Tankel. He's with us from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. He also teaches at American University. His new book is called Storming the World Stage, Lashkar-e-Taiba, about the Pakistani terrorist group of that name. Steve, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Brian, thank you very much for having me.
First, what's the latest you're hearing about Sunday's rampage? It was said to be by a single U.S. soldier who left his base and went house to house in the Panjway district of Kandahar province, gunning down 16 civilians, mostly women and children. He is in custody. What else is known?
So one of the, I think, important aspects of this is that he was assigned to an outreach program that's called Village Stability Operations. This is essentially training local villagers to be part of an Afghan local police force. And these have been seen to be effective in keeping the Taliban at bay, in some of these more remote villages. Now, he wasn't doing the training himself. It's special forces, small units of Green Berets or Navy SEALs that do the training and are, you know, responsible for cultural engagement. The staff sergeant was essentially providing security for the base on which they were working and would have been in charge of things like, you know, restocking ammunition and things like that. But the fact that he was providing, you know, in charge of base security helps to explain perhaps why he was able to wander off the base. Now, what's particularly I think important here is that these village stability operations, at least according to the U.S. government and coalition forces, are seen to have been quite effective, and they were one of the tools in the toolkit that, you know, the coalition forces were looking at in terms of the importance of the handoff, the transition a couple years down the road. So to the degree that this makes those types of engagements more difficult, I mean, that's just adding another challenge to what is already a very challenging engagement.
And Afghan President Karzai understandably called it an act of terrorism when civilians are targeted like that. Or it may be a troop who broke under the stress of war and went berserk. I don't know how much is known. But what's the relationship of this murder spree by one individual to the bigger U.S. policy?
The truth is we don't know, what led him to engage in this act. I mean, clearly this is a very troubled individual, and it's certainly we can speculate that this comes at a time when, some Afghan trainees have turned their guns on U.S. trainers. It's been reported that he served several tours in Iraq. I read one news report that he might have suffered a traumatic head injury at some point. We don't know what triggered him to go on this rampage. What we do know in terms of, how this is going to impact the wider mission is that, whatever the motivations behind it, this will be interpreted, by many Afghans as an example, of U.S. Soldiers who at the least are unconcerned with Afghan lives and at worst, are set on taking them. The issue for the U.S. in part is going to be to try to portray this as an aberration as opposed to sort of signs of a doomed mission. But obviously the Taliban is going to be dead set on promoting the opposite.
Listeners, if you want to get in on this with an opinion or a question about what the United States should do next in Afghanistan, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show with Steve Tankel from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. There are 68,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan today, according to government figures, with a gradual drawdown plan through 2014.
Yep.
Why would the rampage, horrifying as it obviously was, change the debate on the big picture of how to train Afghan forces for self-sufficiency and how quickly to get out?
I think that's an excellent question. I think there are two things that are happening here. One, it has changed the mission in some regards, or has the capacity to. But before I come to that, I think it's important to point out that part of what's happening here is the Quran burnings a couple weeks ago, and then this rampage. They bring into stark relief some of the wider issues that have already been apparent and that have already brought into questions the quote doability of this mission in terms of the level of trust between Afghans and U.S. soldiers. Because if trust doesn't exist, certainly between those who you're trying to train and the trainers, then that becomes all the more difficult. And it also just highlights, the sense that this mission is going from bad to worse. Now, in addition, it also makes it more difficult because even if it is an aberration, it is not perceived as such. It is obviously a very understandably neuralgic issue, and that's going to make it harder to do several things. One, those village stability operations that I mentioned. Two, the U.S. is in the midst of trying to negotiate a strategic partnership agreement, which will look at how many troops are left in country after 2014, what that residual force will look like, what the conditions on their operations will be, whether or not they will have immunity, with regard to civilian casualties. Recall that was one of the issues with Iraq that led ultimately to the withdrawal of all of the forces. So at the time when they're trying to negotiate a strategic partnership agreement that already has several very difficult issues entailed in it, the most prominent being night raids by special forces, which President Karzai has come out against a number of times, another being handover of prisoners. This just makes those negotiations all the more difficult because tensions are so high and trust is receding.
And so in terms of what to do, the New York Times is reporting today on three different positions within the Obama administration, within the White House, and the basics are this: 20,000 troops are already scheduled to come home this September. National Security Advisor Thomas Donilon wants to speed that up to add another 10,000 by December and another 20,000 to 30,000 by the middle of next year. So that would be over half the troops out in a year's time. Vice President Biden wants an even faster transition to a special forces-only operation going after suspected militants who could plan attacks against the U.S., and that's supposed to be the mission over there, to reduce the ability of terror groups to plan more 9/11s on our soil. Here is the president himself yesterday on KDK Radio in Pittsburgh sounding pretty conservative on how quickly to get out.
Well, I think it's important for us to make sure that we get out in a responsible way so that we don't end up having to go back in or deal with Al-Qaeda resurgent and potentially launching attacks against us. And so what we've tried to do is create a responsible pathway for an exit, where by the end of 2014, we'll have all our troops out.
So President Obama yesterday, and Steve Tankel, I don't expect you to necessarily have sources in the White House knowing who has the edge in this debate, but is it just a matter of numbers, or is it a matter of also figuring out what the mission really is from this point on?
The two are intrinsically tied together, of course. Is it going to be just counterterrorism? And if so, is the what you could call the counterterrorism architecture going to look similar now to what it has been vis-a-vis Al-Qaeda? Remember, those are the actors that the U.S. is most concerned with in the region, but they're not the only terrorist group with, regional or global reach in that neighborhood. There are others based in Pakistan as well. And part of, the mission in Afghanistan tries to keep, an eye on those other actors. There's also questions about, how quickly can you transition down and still do the type of support and training necessary, that you need so that the Afghan National Army doesn't collapse and Afghanistan doesn't descend into civil war once you have withdrawn. I mean, yes, I think it's fair to say that ensuring Al-Qaeda does not return to Afghanistan and cannot launch attacks against the U.S. homeland remains objective number one. But there are also concerns about the stability of Afghanistan, the impact that will have on Pakistan, on the wider region. It's not as though, if there were a civil war there, that it was going to be completely self-contained. There would be a lot of different regional actors that would become involved. And so a lot of the debates that are taking place right now are, can that be avoided? What needs to happen for that to be avoided and at what cost.
Let's take a phone call. Bob in Black Rock, Connecticut, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Brian, what a pleasure to be on your show. The thing that's happening here, I think, is that you two are having a very logical discussion, but it takes an eye off the ball in the sense that what you're logically discussing is completely irrational. We shouldn't even be there. And, obviously neither of you put us there, but it does take our eye off that ball.
Well, but here we are. And inside the White House, they have to have logical and rational discussions about what to do now, right?
Maybe not. This is my point. In other words, I think the first thing you should have done was just gotten out. Whoops, big mistake, we're out of here. And it's been how many years now?
It is crazy. It's been over 10 years. Is it the longest war, Steve Tankel, that the U.S. has ever fought?
Yeah. And it's important to point out that there was overwhelming support for the mission when it started. I mean, the U.S. had been attacked. They had been attacked by actors based in Afghanistan. The Taliban regime was not prepared to hand over bin Laden. And so, all of that was very understandable. And then, of course, and we don't need to revisit the entire history, but there was drift in that mission for some time thereafter. Up until 2003, 2004, things appeared to be going quite well in Afghanistan, and there's been a rapid descent since 2004, 2005. The quip has been made before that the U.S. wasn't in Afghanistan for fighting the same war for 10 years. It's been fighting a different war every year for 10 years or 11 years. So, I think to your point, Brian, we are there now. I certainly understand the desire for the U.S. to withdraw. But the question is how to do that without creating more problems for ourselves and for the region. And that's something that a lot of people are wrestling with right now. And it's not just the military issue. There's also the fact that the Afghan economy right now is in many ways being supported by all the money, the U.S. money, and other international money coming in. And what happens to the economy when, forces begin to pull out, and again, not wanting to see just complete instability if that is avoidable, but then asking the question, can it be avoided and at what cost?
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we talk about what the U.S. should do now in Afghanistan and whether the rampage by a U.S. soldier killing 16 civilians on Sunday should play any role in the larger policy formation. And coming up in just a few minutes, have we got a right-wing power structure gossip story for you? The Koch brothers versus the founders of the Cato Institute think tank. Apparently, the Kochs want to transform Cato from libertarian to straight conservative, but the forces of libertarianism are resisting, and we will have one of the players on the show in just a few minutes. When we finish up with this conversation, Cato co-founder David Bowes will be on. But continuing on Afghanistan, Reem in Oradell, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question is, there's a lot of talk about counterterrorism initiatives, and I'm just wondering if they're also thinking about, if the forces there are also thinking about how to rebuild the country, talking about infrastructure and the economy, getting people educated, getting people homes, getting electricity and water to these rural areas, and kind of what's the outlook on that?
What is your preference along those lines, Reem? Because we heard the previous caller skeptical of U.S. power, skeptical of the, capacity of the mission to really accomplish anything, saying this is just lunacy, don't even have this conversation, just get out.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to see Afghan infrastructure built, do you want the U.S. to stay there and try to do that, or would you rather just see them get out and stop their participation in the killing?
I think since we're already there, I think it would be fair to at least start the process. I don't think it's enough to just go in and have military bases and then just walk out. I think that if we could at least give them some kind of a start on rebuilding their country, I think that would probably be the best thing. And I think perhaps starting with, just the basics, streets and electricity, water, I think that would be a great way to build trust and gain some of their confidence back.
Reem, thank you so much for your call. So Stephen Tankel on that. On the one hand, we look at Americans in Afghanistan, we look at the response to what goes on after an incident like this, and we say, gosh, we should just get out of there and leave those people alone. On the other hand, what responsibility do we have to the Afghan people to stay? There was the same debate in Iraq once the war was over for most Americans. The U.S. invaded and displaced the old order, awful as it was, for our own purposes. Can we just leave them now in Afghanistan to the chaos we unleashed? It can be hard to figure out which is worse for the majority of Afghans, us staying longer or going away very quickly.
Yeah, and it's important to point out that the U.S. has been, and as have other coalition partners and a host of non-governmental organizations, been attempting to rebuild parts of the country. I mean, there's a lot of aid money that has been flowing into Afghanistan. There are a lot of different projects that are taking place. You know, as Reem mentioned, you know, in terms of trying to build the nation. So that is happening. Of course, you know, there's the question of what is and is not possible in Afghanistan under a specific time frame. As President Obama said, you know, I think several years ago, the nation that he's most interested in building is this one, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and so at a time when there are, you know, budget deficits and money is tight, there are questions about what can be accomplished in Afghanistan in terms of nation building. And I think there is a sense that while some of this will need to continue, that the idea of being able to build an Afghanistan along, Western country lines is not something that is not going to happen, and we're looking at maintaining as much stability as possible as we have a drawdown. I should mention that one of the other issues is that all of this is, of course, not happening in a vacuum. It's tied to security. And I just give one example of this to highlight how difficult these issues can be and how interconnected they are, which is that President Karzai, understandably has been, pushing for some time for armed security contractors to leave the country. And General Petraeus, when he was there several years ago, was able to dissuade President Karzai of that, but he's again making that push. And a lot of the non-governmental aid groups that are operating there now have said that if they are not able to have security contractors, at their headquarters, at their offices, that they will need to pull out of the country. So a lot of the people who are there doing the rebuilding mm-hmm. have said, we may have to leave because it's impossible to just, the Taliban does not want, the U.S. or the international community to be able to build up the Afghan nation because that is one of the ways in which you win the population over right. to your side.
A catch-22, if ever yep. there was one. One more call. Joseph in Middletown. You're on WNYC. Joseph, thank you for calling.
Thanks for having me on. First of all, let's stop using the word rebuild. This is a country that was never built to begin with. This is a 90% illiterate country success be 75% illiteracy? I don't understand what we're doing there at all. I'm tired as an American who wholeheartedly supports our troops of hearing us constantly apologize to these people. Karzai never once apologized to us when his soldiers turned their guns on our men. And when our men are constantly dying, when we're spending billions and billions of dollars over here, I don't hear thank you, I don't hear sorry when they do things that are wrong. I really just think we should just leave them to be what they've been. Let them live in the past eons as they've always done, and just take our soldiers out, because constant apologizing means you're not ready to fight a war.
Now, we've heard some of this on the Republican presidential campaign trail, Newt Gingrich and others talking about we shouldn't be apologizing to them. They don't apologize to us for all the horrible stuff that they've done. But that usually comes paired with we have to stay in and fight to win the war. But that's not your position. Why don't those two things go together for you?
Because I don't understand what we're attempting to accomplish over there. I mean, what is the end game? This is a country of illiterates and drug dealers. I mean, this is, the streets of New York yeah. City are flooded with Afghani yeah. opium. I mean, it's ridiculous. We're doing nothing about that. I don't understand what we're attempting to accomplish.
Joseph, thank you very much. And that's painting with a broad brush. In fact, I think literacy in Afghanistan is a bit higher than 10%. Do you know, Steve?
I don't know the exact numbers. I believe it is a bit higher than 10%. I would also, most of my work is on the Pakistani, you know, yes. side of the border. But I would caution
Still,
between.
I just don't like the language. I just want to note that to paint the whole country as a nation of drug dealers
exactly.
and illiterates, we can do better than that.
I was going to say I don't have a lot of my colleagues and friends who've spent a fair amount of time on the ground in Afghanistan will tell you that that overwhelmingly what you're talking about are some of the smartest and most welcoming people who quite honestly want to live their lives in peace the same way most people do around the world. So I would be very I would be very cautious about painting such a broad brush.
And if they're dealing drugs, it's probably to satisfy Western demand, but that's a whole other segment. One minute left.
Yep.
What does the Karzai government actually want? Is Karzai ripping the U.S. in public for domestic political reasons, but begging us not to abandon him in private?
Not to be flip, I think that if I could give the definitive answer for what the Karzai government wants, that I would probably be the only person who could do that. And that's part of the thing, is that we're not quite sure. The Karzai government is desperately afraid of the U.S. leaving because they feel that they are then vulnerable. But at the same time, they are not strong enough that they can sort of stand up and defend the U.S., military or coalition forces staying. They're a weak government that wants to survive as long and to the degree that is possible. And that's probably as simplistically as one could say it. But they're not a strong partner, and that makes the job of coalition forces all the more difficult.
Well, the U.S. is trying to prevent al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups from attacking the U.S. again, but war is fought for a nation's big goals, yet sometimes it's the isolated incident that can turn a war, like the lone wolf U.S. soldier who went on a rampage against Afghan civilians earlier in the week, which seems to be changing the conversation even inside the White House. We thank Stephen Tankel from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also teaches at American University and is the author now of Storming the World Stage, Lashkar-e-Taiba, about the Pakistani terrorist group of that name. Thank you very much for coming on.
Brian, thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And up next, the Koch brothers versus the Cato Institute. Stay with us.